This is Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Okay, today I have this, went to the Encircle Films screening that they do once a month. This one was on Roger Stone, a movie called A Storm Foretold, about Roger Stone's machinations behind the scenes of the January 6th riots, and including it, and it has many interesting scenes, including when Stone finds out that he's not in the inner circle of Trump's political machine. He ends up, he develops a tic, and he has since said that this has been generated, AI generated, and it's not real. But a very interesting movie. And during the talk, they had the head of the Real News, the founder of the Real News Network, talks about a lot of this stuff and underreported news of what is really going on. And something I've been saying for years, it's Dick Cheney has been trying to take over the United States for years. Okay. And I'm working on some stuff about that. That I will have in the future. But yeah, and I just want to say one thing. This is my own observation about the Middle East. And my prediction is what history will show is that what tipped the balance in the Middle East crisis was tourism. And the reason I'm saying that, and this is just me, total speculation from me, please use your own brain and form your own opinions and do your own research. Don't listen to me. But what I'm saying is when they moved the embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv during Trump's reign, I said to myself, you know what? They're going to build a Trump hotel in Jerusalem. And that's why I'm saying it's tourism that was finally what the tipping point was for, and money, and the money that they would make for tourism. And what I'm proposing right now is we should make sure there is never a Trump hotel in Jerusalem. And tourism... I'm not sure about tourism in Israel, what's going to happen for the next 50 to 100 years for Israeli tourism after all this mess. But there definitely should never be a Trump hotel in Israel. So that's what I'm calling for. All right, so yeah, coming up, Roger Stone and Paul Jay of the Real News Network. Let's see, it's Gundafson. Nobody can pronounce this guy's name. I don't see why it's that hard to pronounce if you... luckily, I learned to spell phonetically. So it's Christopher Guldbrandsen is from Denmark. He doesn't talk that much. Both of them were doing us a big favor in even speaking over Zoom. But Paul Jay of the Real News Network has some very provocative... things going on and some solutions, and at least some information that will get us to solutions, which is what I try to do here. So yeah, this is a very good segment here on Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
Okay. My name is Phil Prince. I'm on the board of Encircle Films, and I'm going to be your MC for our discussion here. Our speakers are Paul Jay on the upper left, and the film's director, Christopher Guldbrandsen. This is something I stole from philfreeway.com. Hopefully it's accurate. Christopher Guldbrandsen's work is inspired by the observational style of direct cinema movement. He is trained as a journalist at universities in Denmark and the UK and has won several prizes ranging from the Peabody Award in the US to the Danish Art Council's grant at home. Guldbrandsen penetrates closed and secretive milieus like no other, from where he draws the material for his documentary dramas. His films are characterized by an expressive realism in structure, form, and content. With understated but effective means, he lets the characters and the drama unfold, building tension and triggering laughter and head shaking over the reality that unfolds. His breakthrough film, The Road to Europe in 2003, was an observational doc thriller about the enlargement of the European Union that created an international stir when it revealed Germany would never let Turkey into the EU. Russian President Vladimir Putin was also upset by the film, publicly protesting he had been recorded during a private conversation. Gulbranson's observational film about the rise and fall of the new political party, New Alliance, has become a satirical landmark documentary and an inspiration for the drama hit series, Borgen. A mainstay in Gulbranson's films is that his ability to turn complicated subject matter into cinema. He highlights the often banal, unassuming actions that reveal essential character traits and emotions of humans in high-tension situations, as we saw. In a striking visual style with a sense of sharply drawn characters, Gulbranson delivers dramas from the political reality among the winners and losers of power. In addition to his film work, Christopher has served as CEO of the Y Foundation, commissioning editor and channel controller for DR, the Danish Broadcasting Corporation. Paul Jay is a renowned journalist and filmmaker, is the founder, editor-in-chief, and host of a web-based news analysis service, theanalysis.news. Paul also founded and served as CEO and senior editor of the Real News Network from 2003 through 2019. Jay was born and raised in Toronto, Ontario, and holds dual citizenship with the United States. A past chair of the Canadian Independent Film Caucus, now called DOC, the main organization of documentary filmmakers in Canada, Paul is the founding chair of Hot Docs Canadian International Documentary Festival. His films include Never Endem Referendum, a feature-length documentary on the 1995 Quebec referendum over the question of seceding from Canada, Lost in Las Vegas, a feature-length documentary for A&E, and Return to Kandahar in 2003, a feature-length documentary that won the Donald Britton Gemini Award for the Best Social-Political Documentary. His television journalism, he was creator and executive producer of the Canadian Broadcasting Company's News World's flagship debate program, Counterspin, a primetime debate show about the news of the day, from 1998 through 2004. Paul was the co-creator and co-executive producer of Face Off, a nightly primetime debate program that ran for 4 years on CBC News World. He worked with Gore Vidal, among others, for the launch of the Real News Network, which included the documentary History of the National Security State. In this, Jay interviewed Vidal, as well as Lawrence Wilkerson, Ray McGovern, and Antonia Yuhas. The Real News went on to launch several video news magazines for which Paul was executive producer, including The Empire Files, created in 2015 with Telesur. He was also executive producer of the 2017 documentary Donald Trump, The Koch Brothers, and The War on Climate Science. Jay parted ways with the Real News Network in 2019, founded theanalysis.news, a video current affairs interview and commentary show and website, and you should check it out. Please welcome Paul Jay.
Thank you.
So we're going to take a little time for our speakers to give a few opening statements. And Christopher, why don't you go first?
Well, thanks. It's a bit of a rough time to come here at 5 o'clock in the morning in where I am to get started with an opening statement. But first of all, I want to thank you all for coming and watching the film. It's an astonishing time we live in, not just in the US, but in Europe and around the world. Dreadful things are going on, and of course we are all holding our breath watching as the American presidential election is approaching. I'm so grateful that you guys came to watch the film today. It has proven very difficult to get it out in the States. We're pretty much given up on getting distribution there, but it's been showing around the world and making sense in that way to have made it. I don't have a big statement to start off with here. I would love to hear your questions, and that's basically it. So I'll pass on the word.
Thanks. Paul?
Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me. Thanks for Christopher to making what I thought was a very engaging film. I think it's nuts he's not getting distribution in the US. I guess my job here is just to add a little bit of context that isn't in the film. And at some point, I'd like to give a far more macro context, but I'll start with some background to January 6th that is very little reported on, almost not at all, was almost ignored by the Congressional Investigative Committee into January 6th, yet it's all on the public record. And when I reported on this, you know, just a few weeks after January 6th, YouTube took down my report, claiming I was spreading pro-Trumpian lies about the election, even though the report was clearly a scathing critique of Trump. They went on to take down another story similar that I reposted and banned me from advertising on Google forever. And then I did another story about the role of Christian nationalism in the military, which is I'll get to because that's a big piece of the context of what led up to January 6th. And they took that down. And they were about to ban me from YouTube altogether until I told Matt Taibbi about it. And he has this thing called the censored. So he got in touch with YouTube asking, why are you taking down Paul J's stories? And then they backed up and apologized and put two of them back up and said they couldn't put the first one back up. But here's what's in the ones that you, this is what YouTube didn't want you to see. This is the reporting. On January 4th, 2 days before the riot on the Hill, an op-ed appeared in the Washington Post. And you probably heard about it at the time, but nobody talks about it anymore. 10 former secretaries of defense warned the military to stay out of the election results. On the same day, Admiral Stavridis, who was the former Supreme Commander of NATO, wrote an article in Time magazine supporting the piece by the 10 former secretaries of defense, saying that when these people heard that Trump had tried to get the Secretary of State of Georgia to hand him X thousands of votes, he says a chill must have gone down their spine. On the same day, and Stavridis explicitly tells the military to stay out of the elections. On the same day, the Financial Times has an editorial, January 4th, that ends with the words, as bizarre as it seems, a coup is in progress. So this is mainstream news sources saying that there's something going on in the military that's dangerous enough for 10 former secretaries to write this op-ed on the Washington Post, and enough for the Financial Times to say a coup is in progress. Now, this is 2 days before what happens on Capitol Hill. So it's pretty clear from what's on the public record. The plan was January 6th was supposed to create an excuse for the military to intervene and there'd be a declaration of martial law, which is a plot that's been reported in mainstream press that was discussed between General Flynn and Trump in the Oval Office. That's on the public record as well. But what happened is Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Milley, and the head of the Army both issued memorandums just after that statement by the 10 former secretaries of defense, ordering the military to stay the hell out. Now, why doesn't all this get talked about? Well, because it says that there was something far more serious going on than just a riot on Capitol Hill, because the riot was the anticlimax of a failed coup. Yeah, there's a lot of windows broke, it happened, a lot of people got hurt, but it was supposed to be a trigger for something far, far more serious. And we can talk about this later if you want. But the bottom line is there's very good evidence that there is a very serious infiltration, if you want. And in the Time magazine article by Stavridis, he talks about this in terms of the far right and Nazis. And so he doesn't talk about Christian right, because they're all afraid of the Christian right. But the far right evangelical right has made very big inroads in the American military. And that's why they took the whole thing so seriously. And these far right Christian evangelicals and such are even at war with the right wing. It's one section of the right wing led by, you know, now I guess you could say Liz Cheney and was Dick Cheney, who, by the way, are the ones that actually organized the letter of the Secretaries of Defense. But the fundamental thing is the rise of a real fascist movement in the United States. It's not new. It keeps attempting to gain power and strength, and it's never had this much power and strength. And, you know, if you want, we can talk about why I think that is. And so, you know, this insight into Roger Stone's role and how this guy, if there was ever a guy that lived up to being a legend in his own mind, you know, how a con man can play such a significant role. On the other hand, near the end, the scene in the car where Stone finds out he's actually a bit player, because the real brains behind all this is Bannon and some others. Anyway, the big picture thing to talk about, I hope more in the evening, is why is there this rise of fascist movement? And then for progressives, how do you balance opposition to that with dealing with a Biden administration that's, you know, a center-right administration at best?
Hello, thank you both very much for being here. Would you say that what you just spoke of, the military being told to stay out of this, is this why there was not more representation of our, you know, of people fighting for these, you know, standing up during the riot? Why weren't we protected? That's one question. The other one is, we all want to know, where is Roger Stone now?
Well, Christopher, why don't you do the Stone question, then I'll do the other one.
Yes. Well, I have to admit I'm not in contact with him and haven't been for quite a while, but I understand. I mean, he's back at his thing. He's occasionally hanging out with Trump, and I think it's pretty clear he's doing what he can to be part of his re-election efforts. I just wanted to add to what Paul said. I can certainly echo his analysis. I think for me, I'm a bit reluctant to call it a fascist movement. For me, it has been, as an outsider, it has more been a sense of watching a pillar of American democracy that the Republican Party has been transformed into an anti-democratic movement. That's how I would see it, but I definitely can echo his look at it. Yeah, so it's passing.
Well, the title of my first piece that YouTube took down was "A Failed Coup Within a Failed Coup," and the question is, when the chief of Capitol Hill Police on January 4th, 5th, again on the 6th, asked over and over again for the National Guard to be on, to come and defend Capitol Hill. Why wasn't that in place? And I used to be accredited on Capitol Hill, and I kind of know how it works. And like, when you go to get your journalist accreditation, you go to the radio and TV office in the Senate side of Congress, because the Senate is considered the senior body. So the chief of the Capitol Hill Police reports to a three-person committee. It's the sergeant of arms of the Senate, the sergeant of arms of the House, and for some reason I have yet to understand, the congressional architect. Don't ask me why he's on this committee. But if he wants the National Guard, he has to get them to sign off. and give him permission, or either they call. So who do they answer to? Well, Sergeant of Arms of the Senate answers to the Majority Leader of the Senate, which is Mitch McConnell. It's not the Majority Leader anymore, but he was then. And on the House, it was Pelosi. Now, there's a report in the Washington Post after the events where the chief of the Capitol Hill Police says he was pleading with the Sergeant of Arms of the Senate to call in the National Guard again from on the 4th and even more on the 5th and even the morning of the 6th. And according to what he told the Washington Post, the answer was, "I'll have to ask my boss." Well, the boss is Mitch McConnell, and they never got back to him, and they never called in the National Guard until something like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, why? So I'll offer you my speculation of why, but it's everything I've said up until now is hard fact, not speculation. I think what happened is when the coup attempt, the Trumpian coup, failed, and when the American elites had decided they were going to crush this thing. There's another thing on the public record nobody but me seems to ever talk about. At 2 o'clock, the doors are breached in Capitol Hill at, I think it's 2:10 in the afternoon. At 2:30 in the afternoon, like 20, 25 minutes later, the National Association of Manufacturers, although I often mix up their name, it's the largest corporate lobby group in DC. They issued a press release calling for Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove Trump from office. This is like less than half an hour after the doors get breached. Now, how did they know the doors were going to get breached? How did this corporate lobby group, which was totally pro-Trump for 4 years, got all the deregulation and all the tax breaks they could ever wish for, but they had decided that Trump was now a total out of control loose cannon and was bad for business. If he wasn't going to allow a peaceful transfer of power, they wanted him gone. There is no way an association like the Association of Manufacturers can do a complete 180 on their support for Trump in half an hour. This had to have been prepared ahead of time. So they knew what was coming. And so you get the statement calling for Pence to remove Trump. Then you get Pence, Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, all supporting Pence in certifying the election. What does that mean? It means the elites had made it very clear to their political minions in the Republican Party, you better transfer power here. We are not going to have chaos of what's been planned here. And they executed it, and they did. And so I think what happened is McConnell, knowing that the Army was not going to intervene, thought a shit show would be in his interest, because who would get blamed for the riots on Capitol Hill? Trump. And McConnell had been eating and kissing Trump's ass for 4 years, being treated like a complete asshole by Trump. He was going to finally have his revenge, which is the riot on Capitol Hill would get pinned on Trump, and this would sink Trump. I called it a failed coup within a failed coup, because the McConnell coup against Trump failed too. They completely underestimated the kind of support Trump had, that nobody gave a damn about. When I say nobody, I mean within the Trump hardcore camp. Nobody gave a damn about American democracy and all this. And in the end, as you can see, Trump is stronger than, ever since, except when he was elected, I guess. So why wasn't there anyone standing up, was your question? Because I think McConnell and maybe Pelosi, there's some evidence, if you want, I can tell you that Pelosi also could have called, given the authorization, and didn't. I mean, I know a lot of detail about this, so I don't know how much you want to hear, but I think Pelosi may have been in on not calling the National Guard. But on the public record, there's no doubt McConnell was in on it. And the only excuse they gave for not calling in is they didn't like the optics. It wouldn't look democratic for National Guard forces to be all over the place, which is a big crock, because underneath, I don't know if you know this, but I've been in these because journalists could go there. The tunnel system under Congress is enormous. You could hide thousands and thousands of troops in those tunnels and nobody would see them. And it's a common practice. You know, I live in Toronto most of the time. Whenever there were big protests against the US embassy here, they would always hide the cops in parking lots a couple of blocks away. So it wouldn't look bad, but if they needed them, they could be right in. So it's a very conscious and deliberate decision. And now we know that the FBI did have information that this riot was going to get violent. They knew they were going to go breach the doors. They were telling Capitol Hill police this. Nothing was a surprise. So not to have the troops there is a very conscious decision.
Yeah, thank you, Christopher, for this film. Very important, and I wouldn't despair that I think it'll eventually be shown in the U.S., and hopefully you'll get some awards for that, for your effort. So the question I have is, how did you find out, you mentioned in the film that Roger Stone had actually planned this pseudo coup for 2016. And when Trump was elected, he didn't need to activate that plan. So the amazing thing is that the FBI has been completely unaware of this until a few days before January 6th. There was an FBI report, I think in Virginia maybe, that something was going to happen. The other question I have is, are you interested in perhaps getting the film shown in universities? For example, here in Eugene, we have a journalism class at U of O that might be very interested in and showing a film like this to their students.
Thank you. Well, it would be wonderful to have it shown at the journalism school. We that would definitely be great. Well, in terms of the Stop the Steal movement, I think it's not a secret that it started back in 16. Roger Stone actually came up with it in late 15, and it was originally designed for the Republican convention, because they were concerned that the anti-Trump part of the party would try to snatch the nomination from Trump. So it was out back then. It was widely reported, and it was actually in its inception also relatively violent. It was Roger Stone threatening publicly to and encouraging people to go to delegates' rooms in the hotels and confront them if they didn't support Trump. So I think it's well reported on that it started back then. It actually then resurfaced during the midterms in 18, where some of these Proud Boys members that are today in prison again went out and used Stop the Steal in Florida to challenge the results. So I think I have no information or knowledge about what the FBI does or doesn't do, but I would assume that they were knowledgeable about this. The chatter about Stop the Steal, the fermentation for the attack on January 6th began, as I think most of us remember, in the early spring of 20. When Trump, when it became obvious after the corona pandemic broke out that he was set to win the election before the corona, before the pandemic. He had a significant lead in the polls. And then when it turned around, he began with this fermenting the ground to challenge the election results, talking about the election being rigged and so. So I mean, it was an escalating process from the spring and onwards to January 6th. So I, of course, know nothing about what the FBI was.
Well, I can add a bit. I think now it's been reported and it's pretty clear the FBI knew weeks and weeks ahead of time and was sending memos about it to the Capitol Hill Police, to DC Police. And the acting chief of police, after the original chief of police was forced to resign, the woman that took over, in her testimony to a congressional committee, she says, we knew and we should have done way more. We knew something was coming and we didn't act. But the first declaration that I'm aware of a real public campaign to led to January 6th was in September. Steve Bannon is on the Tucker Carlson show. And he says, tomorrow I'm beginning a national tour to organize a Stop the Steal campaign. And on November 5th, we go to war. And Carlson says, yes, I'm sure you're right. So FBI, who must also have these groups infiltrated, but the whole thing was kind of organized in plain sight. I don't think it was very secret, actually.
I think one of the challenges is what to take serious, because the development of policy in the MAGA movement is erratic and is impulsive. And in my, what I witnessed was just, of course, there's intention, but there's also a lot of coincidence. I mean, but in terms of the Stop the Steal movement, it began way before Trump Stone was first commuted. He was in the later pardon, but it began for him. I think it was part of his plan to inspire Trump to commute his sentence, was to very heavily push these baseless accusations of voter fraud. So he did that very publicly for months until he was commuted. So I think that was his, you know, self-serving interest and part of that. So it merged together. Yeah, that's just a small nuance to it.
Hi, I actually have lots of questions, but I know the night is long. So, but I actually had a question. Have you heard back from his people following this being released? And particularly that comment, you will be murdered, obviously is a dramatic one or whatever he said at the end there. But I'm also curious if you're worried that he has power to make it so it won't be released widespread around the country.
I couldn't hear the question. There's something about me being murdered. And that's it.
I just was wondering if you'd heard from his camp or anybody from any of his people following this. And if you were ever worried about that comment or any kind of ramifications against you or the film?
I'm not worried at all. There's a lot of talk about violence and so on, but thank God, I think I don't think there's any risk of that, but there's a lot of chatter on the internet, but my communication with the Stone camp has been limited to a cease and desist letter. That's basically it since then. Of course, there are, and he has, what I find, well, it's just on a curious note, he has explained his outbursts regarding Trump by saying that it is AI generated, that I work in collaboration with the Danish intelligence services, which from this side of the pond is extremely funny. But what is interesting is that the followers and the people and this Trump media environment climate on the net, they have pretty much accepted that explanation. I think that's an interesting point. I mean, he has really managed to convince a lot of people around Trump and Trump allies that it is AI-generated film.
So Cheney is known for his continuity of government, and he was in, even 9/11, he was running things during 9/11. And Biden is, I call him the Duke of Delaware. That's where corporations go to spawn. And then, I don't know how to ask this question, but who is the real fascist here? And then it seems to me Steve Bannon, I relate his stuff to the Turner Diaries. He seems to be pulling stuff out of the Turner Diaries. To me, it seems more Cheney would be the one. I think it's a fact that he was running NORAD. He had NORAD on during 9/11, running maneuvers. Anything on Cheney?
Well, who's the real fascist? Is a good question. So let's back up. What gives rise to fascism is a system of monopoly capitalism at various stages of crisis. So the way for me is to look at it is the underlying cancer is global monopoly capitalism. And it metastasizes in kind of tumors. So I would say Trump's like a tumor. Where Biden and represents the systemic cancer, but you can get these tumors that can kill you even before the systemic cancer will kill you. So you know so it's a problem because the more immediate problem is the tumor. But that tumor is very significant. I've described Trump as the buffoon tip of a fascist spear. It's not new. You know, there was a coup attempt in 1932, against FDR, Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan and some of the biggest billionaires in the United States went to General Smedley Butler and asked him to be the face of a coup to essentially overthrow FDR because they didn't want the New Deal. And Butler, instead of going along with it, and Butler at the time was the most famous soldier in the United States, he went to Congress and testified about the attempted coup. And the congressional committee in the end adjudicated that everything Butler said was true. Now, nobody was prosecuted, of course. The far right of American capital, of American elites, have been wanting to undo. Well, if you want to go to the furthest far right, they want to go back to what almost to a slave system. Then you have a section that wants to undo the New Deal. They want to undo. They don't consider liberal democratic institutions in their interests, except when they win. But if they lose, then they couldn't care less if those institutions are destroyed. So at the present, what is the real underlying problem? I think the underlying problem is there's two fundamental processes that have been going on in the United States from the beginning of the 20th century. Financialization, which is the power of the banks, and militarization. And they go together. You know, they talk about the military-industrial complex, but who owns that, especially now? Is the financial sector owns the military-industrial complex. So the inequality has gotten so extreme. The financial sector is so bloated, they don't even know what to do with all their money. They have to gamble and have the ridiculous derivatives and subprime mortgage schemes. It's so parasitical. But so much money is being made by so few people, and they're living in this bubble, which is an orgy of profit. And they can be in denial of almost everything, including the climate crisis. You know, I'm working on a film now called How to Stop Nuclear War, based on Ellsberg's book. You know, we are as close to nuclear war as we've been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Dan Ellsberg and some others think it may be more dangerous now than it was back in 62. But the people with real power are in complete denial. And so the sort of activist sections politically of the elites right now, they don't have the most money, but they're far more active, is the far right. And a lot of them are not just, just manipulative. A lot of them are actually fanatical true believers in what's called Christian dominionism, and they really believe the United States is God's chosen vehicle, and liberal democracy and Democrats are betraying God. And yes, we don't care whether Trump's charged with 91 felonies. God, all the vehicles that serve God are imperfect. It is a crazy metaphysical fabric, whether it's QAnon or it's not just all evangelical. Some of it's far right-wing Catholic, like Opus Dei, which is probably at least half of the Supreme Court. But it's a reflection of how decayed and parasitical the whole system has gotten. So that's the underlying, if you want the answer, who's the fascist? Well, the system gives rise to this, but if you want to be specific, there is a movement of the far right elites who have been able to mobilize sections of the disenfranchised and dispossessed working class. And of course, we've seen this before, you know, obviously in Germany and Italy and other places. And anyway, I can, like I say, I can talk about this at length, but there's, if you want to, I can do more. But who's the fascist? Right now, there's an immediate danger from the Trumpian right. There's a systemic danger that if we don't deal with the myopia and denial of the billionaire class, the climate crisis and nuclear war, we won't be around too much longer. I mean, you know, climate is going to completely demolish global civilization, maybe in 30, 40 years, maybe less. A nuclear war, frankly, could happen anytime. It won't be deliberate, but accidental nuclear war could happen tonight.
One last question.
This is for Christopher. I wanted to thank you for making this important piece. It's outrageous that it's not widely available here. I hope it does become widely available here soon. But I wanted to know if you knew before making this what you were getting into, if you knew what a nut job Roger Stone was before you spent all that time with him.
I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I have to be honest and say, I pretty much stumbled across Roger Stone. I started out, I traveled to the United States to make a film about something I didn't understand. For all its flaws and shortcomings, America has, in my perspective, always been a pillar of stability in the international community. And that I found seemed to be changing radically. And I wanted to try to understand these changes. And I went after this. I mean, I started out in 17, and it was what I really didn't understand was how the lying we were talking about, the loudest liar wins. That was kind of a change. I mean, there's always been a contract between citizens and politicians in modern democracies. There's a certain level of lying going on, but it had kind of moved beyond that. And I started out looking into this Seth Rich conspiracy story way back then, and it quickly became, it wasn't that interesting. And in that process, I stumbled across Stone, and that was just, it was his role in spreading all these conspiracy theories that and lies, basically. It was looking into that, that was the reason for me to meet him. And then when I met him, I realized he was scared. He was very afraid of that he would be arrested, and that whole process about him and his role in the Russia investigation was about to unfold. So that was, I just kind of just got into it and stayed with him from then. So the short answer to the question, I had no idea what I was getting into. And I think that relates to where we are at now, that everything that happened was something they said they would do before it happened. So why I was surprised by it, I don't know, because I mean, I could just have paid attention, but I think that goes in a broader perspective as well. For me, the lesson at least was, I take everything Trump say today literal. And I have very little question that these dystopian ideas that he has are things that he and his movement might actually realize.
I think we're just about out of time, but I want to push it and ask you both one question and maybe take a minute each. What do you think the chances are of violence around the 2024 election?
I will let Paul take the
lead. You want me to go? Oh, extreme. This force that was strong enough within the military, and I should also, in terms of that FBI question, say the military, the FBI, police forces too, none of them are monolithic. They reflect the divisions in society. So in the military, you have sections that are far right evangelical, far right politically, and you have sections in the military that are, you know, more centrist and like Milley, you know, he's, you know, if he's told to go blow up a country, he will. On the other hand, he kind of respects the chain of command and so on. but this, the forces that have been rallied, gathered, organized by Bannon and the far right wing billionaire class have absolutely not gone away. And when they say, of course there'll be another Stop the Steal campaign if they lose, unless it's a landslide. Like if it's absolutely overwhelming, okay, maybe, but it's not like the way it's going now. Who the hell knows what's going to happen given the polling? But yeah, it's very possible. And then the question will be, you know, will it come down to, can they control the far right of the military police forces or not? I would guess they can, this assuming there's a Biden win. But yeah, it could get pretty ugly.
And Christopher, your feeling?
Well, I hope for the best. I think it's very important to remember that the presidential election in the United States is not only about America. It's something that will inspire and impact democracies around the world. I think you cannot overstate the significance, not just of the results, but how it is played out. So I hope for the best, fear the worst.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. That was brilliant. And I, on behalf of the audience and in Circle Films, we wish you both good health.
Yeah, I could use it. I didn't Cheers. Cough as bad as I had it.
Thank you.
All right, thanks everybody.
A quick reminder about our film Into the Canyon next month on the 21st, I believe, and your opportunity to pick up some free passes to the following speaker series with the directors and the climbers in that film. Thanks for coming. Say, where are you going? To the
scene of peace to peace. Sends out hero fire, cast the priest into the fire, prays for all bad sinners, watch them eating dead rats in the say where I you go.
Ferry's Red Boots, and I'm gonna find a new album.